Artist Gregory Allen Elliott is at the center of a landmark trolling case that might land him behind bars and forever change what any of us anywhere can or cannot say online.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out. Nobody will be safe. You better shut up, because if you don't, he could be going to jail.
Gina's blog earns her family a decent income. She writes about being a stay-at-home mom, but from a pro-choice, modern feminist perspective. And a large, active community of like-minded women has grown around her blog.
I like to see that recognition response when someone else goes, oh, me too. And that's so validating. That's why I do it.
Psychologists and psychiatrists have been somewhat taken back by the huge amount of negativity there appears to be on the internet. And it may be that the internet has unleashed a kind of dark demon within millions of people out there in the general public. We think that one of the things that's problematic about the internet is it normalizes extreme behavior. So because you see a lot of people on the internet behaving in an extreme fashion, you think it's more normal than it might actually be. And the other thing is it seems to encourage a herd-like piece of behavior. If one person starts being negative and a group of people pile in behind them, there's a kind of cascade effect, which you don't see in ordinary life outside of the internet.
Hounding people when they are most vulnerable, like at the time of a loved one's funeral, is a surefire hit for the troll.
That's the easiest way for us to create a mass effect. It's really effective when you have all these people who are already emotional. Drop this bomb on them, you know, with the gore photos, maybe some kind of sexually explicit photos. It sends their emotions into overdrive.
But what do the trolls get out of seeing these distraught reactions?
I was a grad student in 1993 at Concordia University of Montreal. Essentially, at that time, the internet was still very nascent, and at that point was just a relatively small number of universities that were connected together. And there was this kind of quasi-bulletin board system called the News Network. You had, for example, a group like Rec.Humor, and people would trade jokes, and I guess what happened at some point was that there were people on Rec.Humor who had a certain penchant for tasteless jokes that was not appreciated by the rest of the community. And so the tasteless denizens were kind of hived off and started their own group, and alt.tasteless was born.
When I used Twitter, I used it as pure form. As an artist, I just went, this is a brush, this is some paint, this is a canvas. I used it to comment on politics. I used it to help people. And I just used it every way possible. One day I responded to every tweet that came across my tweet stream. And then someone said, you don't have to respond to everything. And I said, I know, right? But today that's what I'm doing as an artist and an experimenter.
At one point, Gregory was sending 300 tweets per day. He was acerbic, sometimes crude, and very opinionated. Inevitably, he made some enemies who wanted to shut him up. Chris Murphy, Gregory's lawyer, explains how Gregory went from volunteering to design a logo for a feminist organization to being arrested and jailed for 3 days.
When Greg called me, he had no idea why the police were there, and neither did I, obviously. And it wasn't until sometime after his arrest, when he was in custody, that he first learned what the police were doing there. And it turned out that there was a woman named Steph Guthrie who had said that Mr. Elliott had been criminally harassing her on Twitter. The medium that Mr. Elliott is alleged to have harassed the complainant, Ms. Guthrie, is on Twitter. That's it. No personal emails, not Facebook, nothing in person, no in-person meetings, no stalking behavior.
There's the one they threw coffee on. You can throw coffee on it, but creating the picture is worth more than 1,000 people destroying it. This is like freedom of speech. This is saying, you know, like, I can comment on what you're doing as long as it's not a threat. You know, if you're hurt, if the truth hurts you, it's not my problem, because I'm just telling the truth.
Mr. Elliott was disagreeing with Stephanie Guthrie's politics. She's the founder of a political organization in Toronto called Women in Toronto Politics. Mr. Elliott was an ally of hers for a number of months. But then there was a break in the relationship because Mr. Elliott stuck up for someone he believed was being bullied by Ms. Guthrie and her friends on Twitter.
Ms. Guthrie, who refused to be interviewed for this film, asked her followers to, quote, sick the internet on a young man who had made an anti-feminist video game, a game that even Mr. Elliott admits was clearly offensive.
There was an orchestrated and dangerous attack on this guy. Right up to that point, I was sending tweets to them saying, look, the guy only has 11 followers. Ignore it. It's not good branding, you know, to destroy people's lives. But they said, screw you, Greg. And I said, okay, well, you're not going to take me seriously. You're not going to stop. I sent a tweet that I'm going to paraphrase it. It said, if you commit suicide, I'm holding you all responsible. And at that point, my helping stopped. The attack started, and I had to start defending.
Gregory didn't know what he was up against. A community had labeled him a troll, and they were determined to get rid of him.
I knew they were trying to get me kicked off Twitter. So at first it was a campaign of intimidation. Second, it was fake identities, using my face and names that were similar to my names, and that's illegal. And if I had felt like it, I could have got whoever did it kicked off Twitter. But then it was the hashtag GAE hole, Gregory Allen Elliott, so gay hole. So this was an orchestrated campaign that ramped up.
Gregory fought back with tweets that were often abrasive and confrontational, but he never broke Twitter's terms of service. That hasn't stopped the justice system from charging him with criminal harassment and imposing bail conditions, taking away his internet use for 3 years.
So what I've had to do for the 3 years, because I was banned from the internet and banned from email, is I've had to rely on family and friends and try and cut into their lives and schedules. Yeah, and to be forced back onto a pencil and erasers is very interesting.
I've spent, I couldn't even count, thousands of hours like this, sitting like this, out of my own time, because he was not able to do his own evidence gathering for his case.
So you have to, the most painful thing is having to go through stream of consciousness blather on Twitter. Not exciting for me, and I can imagine it's even less exciting for everyone that was helping me out, so.
Sifting through the intricate web of thousands of tweets and retweets made one thing abundantly clear to Gregory's lawyer, Chris Murphy.
Gregory Allen Elliott is not a troll. There's no way. He is either communicating a political message or he's defending himself against their slander. Those two things do not make you a troll. He wasn't going near them physically, wasn't saying anything threatening, wasn't saying anything sexual to them. He was communicating about politics, and he was following the rules on Twitter.
But because Gregory wouldn't shut up, his accusers went to the police, saying that they felt threatened. Now Gregory waits for the judge to decide his fate. Freedom or 6 months behind bars.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out, because nobody will be safe. What you're gonna do if you're involved in a political conversation online and the mob comes to shut you up, you better shut up. Because if you don't, you could be going to jail.
Internet trolling has two essential parts, the attack and your reaction. A big reaction is what the trolls crave, and the way you respond determines whether or not you are a worthwhile target.
If it's just somebody that's just going to, you know, block us and that's the end of the game, ah, well, you guys suck. That doesn't provide too much entertainment.
Prolific troll Wild Goose and the Wagoner crew are all about the lulls, the laughs their victims provide. They call them lulz cows, so there's a logical limit to how far they'll push them.
There's a symbiotic relationship between the internet troll and the lulz cow. The Bill Wagoner crew has never pushed anyone towards suicide, nor have we tried to. That's never our intent. Why would we kill a perfectly good lolscow? If we were to knock them off the internet or out of real life, what benefit would that provide us? You know, how are we going to get any lols out of someone who's 6 feet underground? You know, last I looked, dead people don't come on the internet.
Stay-at-home mom and professional blogger Gina Crossley Corcoran faces a politically motivated faction among her trolls. They disagree with her opinions on home birth, breastfeeding, and the healthcare system, and they want to drive her blog off the internet altogether.
I have a large reach, but I don't feel like it somehow makes me better than anybody or makes me some sort of powerful figure, but they see it as very powerful, and that's why they want to shut it down.
A few years ago, a coordinated trolling campaign drove away all of Gina's sponsors.
There were a couple of brands that hung on, but ultimately they were like, listen, these people are flooding our Facebook page with negative comments and hateful comments and talking about our families now, and we just can't do it. So suddenly, almost overnight, I had no income base, but I had what had become an expensive blog to run.
Gina took a chance and put up a paywall. Fortunately, it turned out that most of her audience was willing to pay to be part of the feminist breeder community. But the frustrated trolls have since stooped to new lows.
One of them called the police and told them that I was committing suicide. So the police showed up at my house at like 3 a.m, woke me up out of bed, and said, we got an anonymous tip that you are suicidal and we have to put you under a 72-hour psych hold. So I was being thrown in the back of an ambulance, crying, you know, upset, afraid my children were gonna wake up and see mommy being taken away. Luckily, I was able to talk to the EMT and I explained to him, like, listen, this person you're saying from Twitter, this person doesn't know me. Please don't take me anywhere. I have kids to wake up to in the morning. And luckily, he sort of saw the situation for what it was, and he, you know, let me out of the ambulance and said, okay, go back to bed. So I found out from the police that anyone can make a call and say that they're worried about you committing suicide, or they're worried about your children's welfare, or and anyone can make an anonymous tip. They don't have to leave their name. So there's really nothing, legally speaking, that I can do about that. My trolls realized that was a good way to use my own local police to harass me and get me out of bed at 3 a.m. In the course of a year, it happened 3 times. So I went to the police and I said, this has to be illegal. And, you know, the local police's response was basically, well, if you don't like it, get off the internet.
When the police cannot or will not help, there is another place that trolling victims can turn.
Nice to meet you.
Please come have a seat.
The victims I deal with come to us very frustrated. They're frustrated with the situation because they feel helpless.
Roman Horak is lead forensic investigator at InfoTransic, an international cybersecurity firm. He tracks down the trolls that law enforcement won't or can't find.
The reasons why the police won't engage the case is because they won't believe there's enough of a serious threat, or they won't have, the person themselves won't have enough evidence.
I've been getting a lot of people threatening me online, and it's scary. I'm not really sure what to do with this.
What sites mainly are they threats coming through on?
Mostly Twitter, but there's a couple on Facebook.
Okay. One of the big questions is understanding the motive of the troll. There's some trolls out there just scrolling the internet looking for someone random to, you know, harass. However, the vast majority of trolls that we deal with are someone who they know. They would have had a relationship somehow with the offender.
Indeed, in the course of their investigations, Roman and his team have discovered that it is people we know, family and friends and workmates, who are most often behind the heinous attacks we can face. But Roman's team has also uncovered a new, more dangerous type of player in the trolling game. Professional trolls. Those who can be hired to settle a score and attack others for money.
Online trolls for hire. The service is available online, almost like a hitman. Some of the guys are very professional. They even create their own malware targeted to that victim. So they write their own code. They, these guys know what they're doing. These trolls for hire could be pretty much anywhere in the world. Romania or Ukraine, Russia, lots from there. Trying to track them down often becomes an international operation, having to coordinate between different law enforcements in different countries.
But, thankfully, the vast majority of trolls are outright amateurs who don't really know how to cover their tracks.
About 85% of people who are doing these things, you know, trolling and harassing people online, are not tech-savvy. Most offenders are leaving a vast amount of digital evidence every day. Every second, every minute right now. Pretty much everything we do online is potentially archived.
Many trolls operate with a false sense of security about their anonymity and of the potential consequences they face if exposed. In England, the law has taken a hard stance and a line has been drawn in the digital sand.
Yeah, I sent some tweets in 2014 and ended up getting a 12-week prison sentence for those tweets.
It wasn't her habit to abuse people online. But today, Isabella Sorley is known as one of England's most notorious trolls. So, what was Isabella's online offense? In 2013, feminist activist Carolyn Criado Perez was campaigning to have a woman's face appear on the next printing of the English £10 note. The public reaction was largely positive. But she was also deluged by a torrent of abusive, irrational, and threatening messages on Twitter. Isabella joined that mob.
That particular night, I was incredibly drunk, and I decided to go home and just send tweets. It wasn't about the campaign. I don't really care what's on a British banknote. I know she was campaigning to have a woman, and the Queen's on the banknote anyway, so I did really not care at all what she was campaigning about. Even now, I don't even know why I sent them. I would love to know why, and I'd love to give like a clear answer. But the real thing is that I was drunk, and I've just jumped on the bandwagon and followed a lot of other people.
The trolls were not debating. They were spewing hate and attacking Criado Perez personally for her feminist agenda. Isabella added 6 threatening tweets of her own. She threatened rape and worse.
I woke up in the morning, like, obviously worse for wear, realised what I'd done. I was physically sick. I don't know if it was down to the tweets or just the hangover. Like, absolutely vile. Like, what I tweeted was disgusting. So to think that I actually typed that out, I felt disgusted in myself that I'd sent those specific words to another person.
Filled with remorse the night after spewing her online hate, Isabella took to the internet to both confess and say sorry.
I apologised to her, went, look, it is an empty threat, do not worry, I'm sorry. I don't know if it reassured her at all, but kind of it made me feel a little bit better that, yeah, she's getting all these other rape and death threats, at least mine is an empty threat, she doesn't have to worry about me falling through with what I said.
But rape and death threats are taken very seriously. 4 months later, Isabella was arrested, along with another troll. Her trial was widely publicized, and she faced the scorn of a nation.
I got a 12-week prison sentence in Holloway Prison. It's hard. It was really hard, because obviously, like, how high profile it was, I couldn't hide away. I had all the prisoners asking why I did it. I had all, like, the prison guards asking why I did it. I was getting a lot of abuse from everywhere. I was being made out to be a woman hate, and then obviously I'm in a woman's prison, so I was like, oh dear, now you got my head kicked in because of what someone had saw, what I'd tweeted on the news. I saw myself on Crime Watch in the prison cell, so that was hard.
After her time in jail, Isabella was ordered to do community service and also pay money to Caroline Criado Perez personally for her online attacks.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Limelight.
By shying away from graphic images of death, news organizations sanitized the violence of Israeli regime aggression against Palestinians. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Elise Swain and Alice Sperry, writers. This article is published under the heading Americans rarely see the true face of Israeli regime's bombing of Gaza. Here's the story. When a ceasefire ended a three-day Israeli regime offensive in the Gaza Strip, over 350 Palestinians were wounded and 46 were dead, including 16 children, according to Palestinian officials. Media coverage in the U.S. was mainly led by photographs of smoke-filled skies or Gazans walking amid piles of rubble. While the photos were accurate and recent, the safety of selecting these images rather than graphic ones effectively portrayed a reality for American audiences far removed from what had truly unfolded on the ground. To look at the totality of images that are made during a news event is an experience most Americans, with the exception of photo editors in newsrooms, rarely experience. As the Palestinian death toll climbed over the weekend, images from photojournalists based in Gaza poured into massive databases like Getty Images and AP Images. A quick search for Gaza on Getty Images, for example, returns hundreds of recent photographs, a near endless grid of brutality from the last week. In many images, children killed by Israeli regime bombs are displayed prominently. These images show funerals, the faces of the deceased uncovered, their bodies held aloft and marched through the streets. In some photographs, mourners are seen taking their own images of the bodies on their cell phones, proof of what horrors have occurred. These graphic images are arrayed on photo databases next to the non-graphic images that are almost always selected for publication by U.S. news organizations. Rockets flying through the sky at night, quiet moments of children surveying the damage done to their homes, and black smoke rising over the horizon. In Gaza, photojournalists routinely photograph within hospitals and morgues. This access to urgent care facilities, rare in the United States, provides an opportunity for journalists to directly document the wounded and dead. On Getty Images, images of children's bodies wrapped in white fabric piling up at the morgue are abundant and uncensored. While shocking and deeply upsetting, they do show very clearly what bombing dense residential areas produces. I can still see the grieving people weeping after their homes were destroyed, Palestinian photojournalist Hossam Salem told The Intercept, adding, I can't handle it anymore. Even after these 3 days of Israeli regime attacks are over, I have become more drained than before. In Gaza, there are no stories that can give us life. All we can say is how death has taken our lives and the lives of those around us. In general, the majority of coverage by international and American media is weak and often does not show scenes where innocent women and children were killed. Soleiman Haji, a Palestinian visual journalist working in Gaza, told The Intercept. In the case of one of the 16 children killed, 5-year-old Ala Qadoum, one report in the New York Times included a photograph made after her death. This was the exception, though the photo was not featured prominently. It was placed near the end of the article. Other outlets from the Washington Post to NBC News did not publish the image, even as they mentioned the girl's killing. What we are left with is, in essence, a sanitized and avoidant understanding of world events as newsrooms uniformly opt for images that do not include any graphic content. Social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook have enforced this shift away from publishing depictions of violence by implementing sensitive media policies that discourage newsrooms from prominently displaying images of atrocities lest they lose page views. There is no consensus on how to deal with images of intense violence. Individual newsrooms make decisions on a case-by-case basis, often after sorting through troves of images filed to major distribution platforms where none of the images are blurred or censored. On getting images only within the caption information is there sometimes an editor's notes warning the viewer about what they're already looking at. Image depicts death. Most media outlets, including this one, issue an editor's note or content warning before surprising viewers with depictions of graphic violence. It is not just Palestinian bodies that are erased from mass media accounts of massacres. School shootings in America and the scenes that have become visually defined by makeshift memorials and candlelit visuals rather than graphic images. And the same is true for the bloodshed that occurs overseas, but there are exceptions. The problem with the representation of Palestinian life and death goes well beyond the images selected to tell the story. Palestinians and many foreign observers have long condemned the international media for sanitizing the Zionist regime's crimes and deferring to the Israeli regime's narrative. In a letter signed by more than 500 journalists following yet another Israeli regime bombing campaign on Gaza last year, the authors, including several Intercept reporters, argued that coverage of the Israeli regime and Palestine regularly amounts to journalistic malpractice. The asymmetry in context does not just extend to the language we use. Stories tend to disproportionately amplify Israeli regime narratives, while suppressing Palestinian ones, the group wrote. Obfuscating Israeli regime's oppression of Palestinians fails this industry's own objectivity standards. Ahmad Abu Artma, a Palestinian writer and human rights activist who in 2018 was one of the organizers of the Great March of Return, a peaceful protest movement by the fence separating the Zionist regime from Gaza, told Intercept that the Israeli regime operated on the assumption that they would have an ally in most of the international media. He said, "This is complicity. We We don't want anything more than for people to know the facts. We don't have a complicated narrative. Our demand is only that people watch the facts, watch the reality, see the footage of what's happening. Across newsrooms, the safe choices of showing an abstracted violence, including calm moments of smoke and rubble, over overt violence, including death, injury, or mourning, fall in line with the framework of the coverage itself, which in Gaza's case regularly downplays the impact of civilians in favor of a narrative about Palestinian militancy, even as the same kind of militancy is depicted as resistance in Ukraine. Mohammad Mohawesh, an independent Palestinian journalist and researcher based in Gaza, argued in an interview with The Intercept that coverage of the latest Gaza assault, which Israeli regime officials admitted was preemptive, focused almost exclusively on the Zionist regime's ostensible justification for attack rather than its impact. And even though the majority of victims were not engaged in acts of resistance, the portrayal of Palestinian resistance, he added, stands in a stark contrast with that of the Ukrainian people. For the past month, newspapers and websites and social media have been filled with the stories of Ukrainian resistance and heroism, stories about soldiers blowing up bridges to delay the approach of Russian tanks and sacrificing themselves in the process. We have seen civilians attacking armed vehicles with whatever they have and common people receiving weapons training and digging trenches, Mohawesh said, adding, and yet, if any of these stories took place in Palestine rather than Ukraine, they would of course not be perceived as acts of heroism and resistance. They would only be classified and condemned as terror. Mohawesh stressed the comparison was not intended to diminish the resistance of the Ukrainian people, but to uphold the right to resist the occupation, military intervention of any land by any nation.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tensions are still high between China and Taiwan. The flare-up comes days after the provocative visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Officials in Chinese Taipei have rejected the one-country, two-systems plan proposed by China for the self-ruled island. Taipei says that only the Taiwanese can decide the island's future. The reaction came after China published a white paper on Taiwan, which Beijing says shows the resolute determination of Beijing to peacefully resolve the unification issue. The paper lays out China's position on the self-ruled island. It says Beijing would never allow any attempt to separate Taiwan, but also would make every effort to achieve unification through peaceful means. Taiwan has accused Beijing of using House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit as, quote, an excuse to destroy the status quo. Pelosi visited the island on August 2nd, despite vehement protests from China.
What they want to do with Taiwan is fight, U.S. wants to fight China to the last Taiwanese. If not to the last Japanese, if not enough, then to the last Korean. Ultimately, the U.S. will not fight the wars. It will finance them. It will give weapons. It will antagonize us. It will antagonize both sides. And that's what they want to do. And it's actually a replica to the World War II.
Beijing reacted with an unprecedented burst of military around the island. The drills lasted for several days. Taiwan has also launched live fire drills in the wake of China's largest ever military exercises. The white paper issued by China this week was the third document of its kind over Taiwan. The previous editions were the Taiwan Question and Reunification of China, which was published in 1993, and the One China Principle and the Taiwan Question, which came out in 2000. China insists differences in the social systems in mainland and Taiwan are, quote, neither an obstacle to reunification nor a justification for secessionism. But Beijing says it will not rule out the military option to achieve such reunification.
What China wants to do with this white paper is just to find a way with Taiwan to get it back to its sense, because reunification will happen. The problem is that if it doesn't happen peacefully, it will happen by force. China doesn't want to do it by force, but it's being pushed on the corner by the US, because the US is actually slowly declaring Taiwan independent.
Speaker Pelosi's controversial visit has undermined the One China policy, which is recognized by nearly all countries of the international community, including the United States. Under the policy, the international community recognizes Taiwan as part of China, and the U.S. is committed to recognizing and having formal ties with China rather than the island of Taiwan. But Washington, contrary to its stated policy, continues to undermine China's sovereignty and courts the secessionist government in Taipei.
So what is the one country, two system? It was applied actually the first time is in Hong Kong. And so since the handover in 1997, they applied the one country, two system. The way it was done in Hong Kong was that Hong Kong could keep its a very high degree of autonomy. And actually they did it for Hong Kong, and it was a way, a showcase that they could show to Taiwan to say, well, in case you were to reunify with the mainland, this would be the system.
China has proposed the one country, two systems model to win Taiwan back. The policy allowed the Chinese government to successfully solve the question of Hong Kong through diplomatic negotiations with the British government. Hong Kong was under colonial British rule since the 19th century. China resumed to exercise its sovereignty over the island on July 1, 1997.
But what happened in Hong Kong was that you had the external forces. You had a massive amount of money being poured by NED, National Endowment for Democracy, and you had the usual suspect, the whole team of regime change working for the US, the MI6, and they did everything to destroy the one country system in Hong Kong, and that ended up with the riots. And then in 2020, you had the national security law.
Under the model, offshore regions like Hong Kong remain under China's sovereignty but can retain their own economic and administrative systems. Now China insists the same model could be applied to Taiwan.
Iran is making giant leaps in its peaceful space program. Iran has just launched its Khayyam satellite into orbit. The satellite was sent into space from the Moscow-operated Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. Khayyam satellite was sent into orbit on Tuesday by Soyuz 2.1B rocket. Iran says it will also use imagery from Khayyam to monitor Iran's borders and improve the country's capabilities in management and planning in the fields of agriculture, natural resources, environment, mining, and natural disasters. After all, Iran is surrounded by US bases, and terrorists have preyed on Iran to enter its soil to conduct terrorist operations. Contrary to claims made by Western media outlets, Tehran insists the Khayyam satellite is fully controlled by Iranian experts and technicians based inside Iran from the very beginning of its launch. However, not everyone is happy about this satellite launch. The US expressed anger at Iran's partnership with Russia and accused Iran that the aim of the satellite is spying, something Iran has categorically rejected. The US has said they suspected that the satellite could be used by Moscow to spy on troop movements in Ukraine. Yet, Iran is resolute in its cooperation with Russia. It has said it will continue production of such satellites with Russia, adding that it's a great honor for Iranian technicians to work alongside Russian technicians who have more than six decades of experience in the field.
Yes, well, the US government, of course, is particularly concerned about this. It really, in many respects, it should have seen this coming. It should have seen cooperation between states that it has under attack coming. But the arrogance, I think, of the US in particular, of Washington in particular, blinds it to these sorts of developments. They could ignore the fact, for example, that small states like Syria, like Cuba, were able to cooperate together. But when large states like Iran and Russia cooperate together, there's the inevitability. There's going to be new developments which free those countries, those peoples, from the domination of the US.
The launch of Khayyam satellite has been hailed as, quote, an important milestone in Russian-Iranian bilateral cooperation that paves the way for implementing new joint projects. It has ushered what Iran has dubbed as its strategic aerospace cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. Russia now says it's open to cooperation in the field of space exploration with all interested countries and partners, specifically Iran. The launch is also seen as a major achievement for Iran, despite Western sanctions.
Okay, so it's very important. The cooperation between Iran and Russia in satellite technology is very important because it shows a cooperation between large states with great capacity, which are both under economic blockade by Washington in particular. I would say Washington rather than the West, because really there are some mixed feelings in some parts of other Western countries. But certainly Washington is very jealous of any sort of independent achievement by Iran or Russia.
Iran says Western sanctions cannot stop its scientific progress. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said that the successful launch of this satellite is a great achievement for Iran. This comes as Iran has made significant achievements in the field of science and technology in recent years. Earlier this year, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Aerospace Force launched its second homegrown satellite into a low Earth orbit nearly 2 years after the launch of its first military satellite. The IRGC successfully put Nur 2 or Light 2 into orbit on March the 8th. Iran has already mastered the technology to build remote sensing satellites with an image resolution of 5 to 10 meters and can inject up to 50 kilogram packages into an orbit of 500 kilometers. But Khayyam can hit a much more precise resolution of 1 meter. Iran aims to achieve the technology to put a 100-kilogram satellite into the 500-kilometer orbit by next year.
Ten years have passed since the start of war in Syria, but the country still seems to be in the midst of a conflict. So who's fighting who, and why does this seem like a war without end? For years, the Syrian war was the biggest news story, but now not so much. Cities and railways are being rebuilt, domestic flights have even started up again. Meanwhile, foreign forces have, on the other hand, ramped up their efforts to push their own agenda. The UNHCR even says the amount of investment to fuel the ongoing crisis compared to the money to alleviate the impact of the war on the Syrian people is very little. When the war started, Syrian government forces fought against US and foreign-backed terrorists. The US, its allies such as the UK and France, as well as Saudi Arabia and others, sided with the opposition and supported these terrorists. But Syria's legitimate government also had its own allies, namely Russia and Iran. Amid the ongoing chaos, terrorists took advantage of the crisis and soon became a common enemy to everyone. Now, over the course of the years of conflict, Daesh continues to operate in northern Syria with the help of the US to achieve its own goals at the cost of the Syrian people. The US has been accused of both hiring terrorists and training them to destabilize the country. This comes while a large portion of northeast Syria's crude oil resources have fallen onto the hands of the U.S. So does this confirm that the U.S. is in one way or another fueling the conflict to continue its illegal occupation and abuse of Syrian resources?
The big question is what right does the U.S. have to be in Syria at all? It has no right. And everyone wants the U.S. out. Probably even Eastern Europe, the EU probably would like the U.S. to be out. So the U.S. is working with the, other Syrian rebels, army defectors, rebel.
The Pentagon has confirmed that the Russian military conducted its second known strike in 2 months near a U.S. base in Syria. Moscow says the airstrike was conducted against a group of U.S.-backed militants in Syria near Al-Tanf. According to some reports, the U.S. then warned the terrorists to move their positions. The U.S. has used these terrorists interchangeably between Iraq and Syria to do its dirty work. It has also transported these terrorists to Afghanistan, with some reports indicating they were transported to Ukraine. The Russian strikes come at a sensitive time due to the Ukraine conflict and tensions between Moscow and Washington. The Pentagon is trying to ensure tensions don't escalate with Russian forces, including in Syria, where the two sides have operated in proximity to each other for several years. Both Russia and Syria have time and again stated that the U.S. is training former Daesh members. Moscow has even specifically stated that Washington is trying to further destabilize the country. It also says that the Al-Tanf U.S. base is illegal and that it and the area around it have become a void where terrorists operate unhindered. Since the Al-Tanf base formation, however, the United States has claimed that it's a temporary facility used to train partner forces to fight Daesh. It has rejected the Russian claims, saying Washington remains committed to killing Daesh and denying it safe havens.
And Russia warned the U.S. over 2 months ago in June. It said, we're going to be bombing. So, you know, and they were actually telling the U.S., okay, we're going to bomb. So then the U.S. can phone up to the Mugawar al-Thawr, the commanders of the revolution, and say, you know, you're going to be bombed. So, I mean, I think that stopped. I think the Russia's getting a bit more assertive now, and they're like the neo-fascists in Ukraine, and there the U.S. is supporting the same kind of rebel forces against Russia. So it's the same scenario transplanted into Syria.
The U.S. cut ties with Damascus over alleged rights violations by the Syrian government. But now, despite attempts by Syria, Russia, and Iran to rebuild the war-ravaged country, American troops continue their illegal occupation of parts of Syria, hindering any such attempts and further proving Washington's twisted logic. Japan commemorates the 77th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Survivors and relatives mark the blast anniversary with a minute of silence. The United States dropped the first atomic bomb, codenamed Little Boy, on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, destroying the city and killing 140,000 people, mostly civilians and including many children. A second bomb 3 days later on Nagasaki killed another 70,000 and made Japan surrender and ended World War II. The bombs also left tens of thousands more dead in the months and years that followed, many from radiation-related illnesses. Many who survived the attacks continued to require welfare and medical care. During the memorial, the Japanese Prime Minister said the government would continue to support the survivors and demanded all nations to work together to promote the total abolition of nuclear weapons. It's still a goal far from being realized, but one held as strongly in the two cities that have suffered the most from such weapons. Meanwhile, the U.S., despite being the only country to have used weapons of mass destruction during a war, seems to have learned no lesson from the horrific incident.
Their weapons should be eliminated from the entire earth. The United States, as a government, as a nation, has learned really no lessons. In fact, Although there was a strong movement to eliminate nuclear weapons in the 1970s, resulting in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, in which the United States pledged to eliminate nuclear weapons, it did not do so, and in fact, over the last few years has committed, from the end of the Obama administration, to a $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization program, which runs directly in the face of any commitment to eliminating nuclear weapons. And so it's really, the United States really has nothing to say about other countries having nuclear weapons until it gets its own act together.
In 1968, the world agreed on a new agreement, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Over 190 countries are currently signed up. Nuclear powers agreed to reduce their arsenals in exchange, others agreed not to have them at all. In the 70s, the deals between Russia and the US continued, more focused on long-range missiles, and though the rivalry between these two global powers intensified in 1991, there was a New START treaty aimed at decreasing the size of their arsenals and underpinning the West's justification for these weapons, which is an idea generally referred to as nuclear deterrence. But now Russia has intensified its rhetoric of using nuclear weapons in the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. The US and the EU, on the other hand, continue to provoke Moscow despite the threats.
Well, there really was no reason for this conflict with Russia other than the way in which it has aided the highly financialized speculative economy of the United States and, by extension, Germany, France, Great Britain, and Israel, which have committed to a system in which now, because of this massive printing of money and the creation of false assets, only a war economy can save them from this catastrophe. So provoking a war with Russia, a thoughtless and dangerous move, does have the effect of increasing the value of the dollar in the short term.
As tensions rise between these two countries, which still have the largest nuclear arsenals, the world is now forced to look at history and the present to avoid an incident similar to the tragedy of Hiroshima. During the 77th anniversary of the world's first atomic bomb attack, the United Nations Secretary General, while calling for disarmament, said the world is playing with a loaded gun.
And today, the world is in danger of forgetting the lessons forged years, 77 years ago. Almost 13,000 nuclear weapons are being held. Stockpiles are being upgraded. And the common thread of potential nuclear annihilation runs through geopolitical crises the world over, from the Middle East to the Korean Peninsula to Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
A clear example of such threat would be Israel, which has persisted on possessing nuclear weapons. Iran has pushed for the establishment of a Middle East zone free of weapons of mass destruction, which the Islamic Republic initiated at the UN. But Israel won't comply. Tehran has even repeatedly warned that West Asia and the entire world is being threatened by nuclear weapons of the Israeli regime and urged international pressure on Tel Aviv to make it join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, an expert group has declared an official drought amid a prolonged dry spell, meaning water rationing may take place in England. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment reporter Helena Horton. The piece is titled Drought Declared Across 8 Areas of England. A drought has been declared across wide swathes of England after a meeting of experts. The prolonged dry conditions, with some areas of the country not receiving significant rainfall all summer, have caused the National Drought Group to declare an official drought in 8 areas of England. The Environment Agency has moved into drought in 8 of its 14 areas, Devon and Cornwall, Solent and South Downs, Kent and South London, Hertfordshire and North London, East Anglia, Thames, Lincolnshire and Northamptonshire, and the East Midlands. Documents seen by The Guardian show the Environment Agency expects a further 2 areas will move into drought later on in August. These are Yorkshire and West Midlands. The group met earlier this summer to discuss the lack of rainfall and decided to put the country in prolonged dry weather status, the first of 4 emergency dry weather stages, and one step before drought. Now the country has been tipped into that second stage. This means water rationing may take place across England, with fewer barriers for water companies who wish to ban customers from using hosepipes and washing the car with tap water. More severe measures can also be put in place at this stage, including banning the use of sprinklers, the cleaning of buildings, vehicles and windows. So far this year, hosepipe bans have been implemented by Southern Water and South East Water. Welsh Water will implement a ban from 19th of August and Yorkshire Water from 26th of August. Thames Water has already said it is ready to go with a hosepipe ban. Those in the meeting were shown harrowing statistics about England's food security. Half of the potato crop is expected to fail as it cannot be irrigated, and even crops that are usually drought tolerant, such as maize, have been failing. The group of experts was told irrigation options are diminishing, with reservoirs being emptied fast, and losses of between 10% and 50% are expected of crops including carrots, onions, sugar beet, apples and hops. Milk production is also down nationally due to a lack of food for cows, and wildfires are putting large areas of farmland at risk. British farmers are deciding whether to drill crops for next year, and there are concerns that many will decide not to, with dire consequences for the 2020